This is talking with Alex Smith at the Haverford AAS meeting on 21st June 76. Now, can you just tell me a little bit about your background, even before you got into radio astronomy?
Well, I was educated as a physicist. I was always very keenly interested in astronomy, and I suppose if the field had looked better, I would have gone into it. But in those days, which I guess you might say were in my late teens when I was electing careers and that sort of thing, it was a sort of situation where you could just about enumerate the number of decent jobs in astronomy in the country on the fingers of two hands.
And we've come full circle.
Right. We're not quite full circle, but we're heading in that direction. And so although I was always, you know, very keenly interested in astronomy and did the usual building, grinding on air, on mirrors, and building telescopes in my teens, and so on and so forth, when push came to shove, I elected to run physics, into experimental physics, and did my undergraduate work in the experimental physics program at MIT, and worked at the MIT radiation lab on radar, of course, during World War II.
Nice.
I graduated in the early stages of the American involvement in the war. I think there were 17 students in my senior physics class at MIT, and I believe it was 17, 13 went into the radiation lab to work on the development of radar. As a matter of fact, I did my senior thesis over there. And then after the war, No, I got my bachelor's degree there in 43, and then stayed on 3 years during the remainder of the hostilities working at the radiation lab.
Do you know anything of Dickey's work, which was actually just after?
I knew Dickey by name there, but I didn't really know him or what he was involved with. That's how I was designing and testing magnetrons. We were very tightly compartmentalized. It was this need to know sort of concept.
Right.
Tried to keep anybody from knowing anymore, and they absolutely had to know in order to do their job. As a matter of fact, my wife didn't even know that I was working on radar.
I see.
And so when the lab was winding down at the end of the war, Walter Gordy, who was there, was going to Duke as a professor. And he went around scouting up some graduate students, and I was one of the ones he scouted up and made a very attractive offer to. And so I went down to Duke to do my PhD work in microwave spectroscopy.
I see.
And we did microwave spectroscopy with molecules for a couple of years there. I actually finished up my degree in only a couple of years. My PhD.
What year
40,
was it?
48.
And what molecules were you doing? Is that,
The CLCN halogen cyanide. And BRCN, CLCN. Didn't do FCN. Wasn't too practical at that time. ICN.
Did you envision at all this spectroscopy and astronomical spectroscopy that has happened in the last 5 years?
Well, in a way, I did. I went to, with my PhD clutched in my hand immediately in 48, went to the University of Florida, where I have been ever since. And I started in, my PhD's dream is to keep on doing exactly what he did for his doctoral dissertation, because one thing he knows he can do, or at least he thinks he knows he can do, he's not sure he can do anything else. And so I kept on working for several years in microwave spectroscopy at Florida, and it eventually got to the point where it seemed like it had become more of a chemist's game than a physicist's game, but in essence, the physicist had demonstrated the principle and developed the equipment and so on, and became more and more a proposition of trying to dream up molecules whose rotational frequencies were in the right wavelength range, and whose vapor pressure was such that it would work in a microwave spectrograph.
Right.
And as I say, it seemed to be edging more toward a chemist game than a physicist game.
You're not reactive to the walls and all this
stuff. Yeah, all kind of boundary conditions that had to be met. And so I became then involved in some work in atmospheric optics. This was in the early 50s when I made the transition. And Korean War, if you remember, started up in that era. And I got involved as a leader, actually, of a rather large project in VHF electronics. And that's what is no longer classified information, proximity fuse work, for the Navy. And was on that for rather intensively for about 3 years, and then got involved in some atmospheric optics work for the Air Force and the Army. And this led, more or less, you might say, to a renewal of my interest in astronomy. At least I was looking in the right direction.
Now, you said that you had some inkling of the astronomy.
Okay. I forget the exact date, but I think it was like the middle 1950s, pretty close around 55, 56. I made a proposal, which, looking back in it, I think was probably ahead of its time, to do millimeter wave radio astronomy.
Spectral one, or is it?
Yeah. It was a reflection of my background in microwave astronomy. And I had become, as I say, I started looking up again.
You had the hydrogen line.
And putting this together with my interest in microwave spectroscopy, my interest in astronomy, I said, maybe there's some future in trying to do this on the sky.
Did you know about the optical CHCN, I suppose?
Yeah.
And you figured why not?
Yeah.
Now, who was this proposal to?
I believe, as I recall, it was to the Army for support. And it was a pretty full-blown proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned down.
This was about 55, you think?
Somewhere in that.
Hey, you think you could dig out a copy of that in your archives?
Oh, I could try.
That would be fascinating to see that. It was about that same time that Towns had an article, which you probably know about now, at a symposium in England, I think it was, suggesting various microwave lines and its possibilities.
Yeah, of course, Towns was one of our competitors in microwave spectroscopy.
Yeah. But you're the first person I've heard of that really wanted to get a full-scale program on. So, having that turned down, then you decided
just about this time, Tom Carr, who had done his undergraduate work and his master's thesis at the University of Florida. He had started to do graduate work at Chicago and then was stopped because of illness. Mm-hmm. He went through a period of rather uncertain health. And he started to do some work at Chicago and had to stop because of his health, and then somewhat later, he tried again at Duke and had to stop again because of his health. And then he went down, he was involved in the bikini test.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I guess it was roughly after that, he went to what then was Cape Canaveral. I guess it's still, or again, once more
right.
Cape Canaveral.
Right.
And became very heavily involved as a civil service scientist in the radio propagation work down there.
Mm-hmm.
And then once more he became very interested in going back to school and finishing up his PhD, and he contacted us in what was then just the Department of Physics, and later became Physics and Astronomy at the University of Florida. And so he came up, there was some kind of a meeting there of some radio types. And I forget now what it was. I think it was sponsored by the College of Engineering. Anyhow, there was a lot of radio types running around all over the place. And so he came up for this occasion, and we talked with some of those radio types to try to get some advice about what we, if there was anything we could do in the way of radio astronomy that wouldn't cost $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I just at the moment can't think of his name, but there was a Frenchman there who did some early observing. In fact, he wrote a chapter in the book, the University, the Big University of Chicago series.
Oh, yes, the Kuiper.
Yeah.
Steinberg?
No. No, it wasn't Steinberg.
I can check that out.
He was very active for a short while in radio astronomy, particularly in observing Jupiter. Then he went to the Bureau of Standards, and I haven't heard anything from him since. I don't know what happened to him, but he was very, very clever, very ingenious guy, very full of ideas. And he was the principal one we talked to, and he told us about the very recent discovery of the Jupiter radiation. He said, you know, gee, here's something strong enough that you could observe a relatively simple antenna that just seems made to order.
Right.
So we said, swell. And we got a few $100 from the physics department budget, which was a significant fraction of the physics department budget in those days.
This was now about how long after Gregory Franklin's?
Less than a year, 8 or 9 months.
Before we get off on this, I just have another question about your proposal for millimeter spectroscopy. Can you remember which molecules you were particularly interested in looking at?
No.
Or frequencies?
I just don't remember.
Just have to dig that up.
Yeah, I'll have to see if I can't find that.
Okay.
It'd be interesting to me to dig it up. I haven't thought about it even for a long, long time. Anyhow, we put up, we had a student observatory, which I had been partially responsible, optical observatory for. We had gotten a gift of a very fine 8-inch Clark, actually, invented by Clark refractor, and had put up a student observatory on campus with this principal, and at least for a while, essentially the only instrument. And so Tom Carr and I, and helped by, very shortly by Colin Barrow, who were in England as a Fulbright student, put up an array of dipole, broadside array, I think something like 8 quarter wave or half wave. Dipole and those sort of things to get out of the radio amateur's hand. At 18 megahertz, Glenn Megasine, in order to listen for Jupiter. We got the thing on the air in 1966. 1956. But our first list was, I guess, remembering back vaguely about the tail end of the Jupiter apparition. And we had our first real full apparition in 1957, which by great good fortune was a time when Jupiter was extremely active. And we got enough results so that we got one or two papers out of it.
Right, I was just noticing your first paper, I think, is 57 Nature, Barrow, Carr, and Smith.
Right, right.
And what were your results at that time?
Well, we detected copious quantities of Jupiter radiation, so we were able to plot the histogram of current probability versus central meridian longitude, and of course confirmed the fact that there were certain apparent source regions that people kind of fall in the three primary regions from which, or at least central meridian longitudes, which seem to generate the most Jupiter noise when they turn toward the Earth. And we also got a good measure of the rotation period, and which put together really with the earlier results gave us a better handle on the rotation period than had been possible because, you know, we had simply extended the time baseline, and that always gives you a...
You mean Shane's results?
Shane. And we then proposed I guess one of our earlier results was proposing a system 3 longitude system based on this new 1957.0, came to be designated, because the zero meridian on central meridian on New Year's, January 1957, and proposed this longitude system for the rotation.
Is that the one that's come to be known as System 3?
The radio System 3, of course, has been revised. In fact, it just very recently has been revised again to a 1965.0 system. Jim Warwick is the principal architect of the latest revision.
I noticed here that you talked about the System 3 and DBS meeting, and then published it in AppJ. I'm just curious about, apparently you felt like you should talk more to the physicists than the astronomers.
Well, we were physicists.
Yeah, and that's how you thought of yourself.
We were members of the Physical Society at that point, I guess, rather than the Astronomical Society. Yeah. I don't really remember when I joined the Astronomical Society. It's like so many people, of course, who came into astronomy through a physics background. That was our, you know, where we've been getting papers, and the natural thing to do.
Yeah, sure.
Now,
that's also the same paper in which you, in the abstract, you mentioned sporadic radiation from Saturn. What can you tell me about that?
Well, it's a very natural extrapolation, since the planets, or at least Saturn, is, I guess one to say superficially, the planet most closely resembles Jupiter. And you have all these fireworks coming from Jupiter. It doesn't take an awful lot of ingenuity to say, well, you know, maybe
right.
Saturn does too.
Right.
And so we early on started listening to Saturn and also Uranus, who was obviously the same thing. And on a number of occasions, we thought that we possibly had heard bursts coming from Saturn. And when we put together these occurrences, they even gave a sensible rotation period.
Mm-hmm.
But the radiation was always so weak and so infrequent, it's nothing like the strong, persistent noise storm one frequently gets from Jupiter, that we were never willing to stake our reputation on and say that with any degree of certainty that we had heard noise. It was simply reported as a possibility. But we never made any positive noise from Saturn. And I think the Yale people were in exactly the same boat. Harlan Smith and Jim Douglas at Yale. That they had the same sort of thing. Unfortunately, none of our observations coincided with the Yale and Florida observations. And it remained in that status, essentially indefinitely. And
did anyone try to make a confirming program or anything like
that? Well, we did. We observed Saturn in more recent years, more powerful of them. And sort of had, I guess you might say, the uncomfortable result that the more powerful the equipment was, the less Saturn you seem to receive. And of course, now finally, last year, I guess it was, Brown at Goddard apparently succeeded in detecting Saturn bursts in the satellite records. And since the radiation bursts that he reported, we've seen the peak in the vicinity of 1 megahertz. It seems quite possible that they may not really be observable from the ground.
Yeah.
We've got an antenna now which was built in part to listen to Saturn, and in larger part to back up the RA2 frequency.
Oh, I see.
6.55 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And we have done a fair amount of Saturn listening to that antenna without getting much satisfaction. And it may simply be that the Saturn radiation is sufficiently low frequency so that it just doesn't essentially penetrate the atmosphere in detectable amounts.
What about the LU at that time in the late 50s? It seems to me like people were claiming comets were giving off low frequency radiation. Venus had bursts, I think it was Krauss that was claiming that.
Yes.
It seems like there were a lot of these things. Just a little too much enthusiasm.
Krauss had fitted, fitted Jupiter radiation, Venus radiation, to an interferometer pattern. You see, we didn't even have that comfort because we were not using interferometers. Well, we had interferometers. We were not using them, I guess you might say, routinely on Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we didn't feel it was the way to go.
Why was that?
Well, I think probably several reasons. One was that we felt that the interferometer pattern was sort of restrictive in terms of observing the actual morphology. You know, you're superimposing the fringe pattern on top of the morphology of the Jupiter noise star. Mm-hmm. We were really, I guess you might say, more interested in mapping the Jupiter noise storm without the pollution of the interferometer pattern. I guess this was one reason. And another reason was we didn't think we needed it, because the mode of operation that we developed early on was to always work with an operator, a live operator,
yeah,
to identify the noise and mark it on the records and eliminate interference if possible if it came along. And our experience was that we could identify genuine Jupiter noise with essentially 100% accuracy with the live operator technique. And I think this was confirmed to a certain extent, I'm a little hesitant to say this, by Jim Douglas's experience at Yale, where they did try to operate with interferometers, and as I understood the situation, essentially got so little data that in order to complete a doctoral dissertation, Jim Douglas had to write us for our data. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of made us think we were really on
the basically, track. You're saying that Jupiter was induced so much less time to the small fringes in the interferometer.
Right.
Right.
And when you combine the highly sporadic nature of the Jupiter radiation with what I guess you could term the sporadic nature of an interferometer pattern, you require a double coincidence, yeah, in order to get your data.
And in fact, what you're interested in, excuse me, is time resolution, which the single antenna can do as well,
right,
rather than angular resolution,
right,
assuming it all came from Jupiter.
Yeah, assuming that you could identify your noise, as I say, it's sufficiently distinctive that we felt we could do it with essentially 100% accuracy. And after we got our Chile station in operation, we had a way of confirming this. And it's sort of amusing that we would have instances where we would have Jupiter noise maybe, let's say, a few centimeters high above the baseline in the face of thunderstorm static that was pinning the pen full,
yeah,
scale, and the observer would mark in the log, gee, I'm almost sure I hear Jupiter under all this thunderstorm noise. And later, when we compare the record to the Chile record, sure enough, this was right in the middle of Jupiter noise storm. It's surprising that once you listen to it, there's virtually no possibility of confusing Jupiter noise with terrestrial static.
Just from listening, though?
Just from listening. And you can well believe we spent a lot of time trying to think of circuitry that would do this, but we never found anything that would do it as well as the graduate student.
Right.
And it's rather odd that the thing which is most apt to be confused with it orally is station. What you probably heard, done like radio listening, a station trying to fade in from the distance and going shh, 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 shh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds like Jupiter. And if all you could do was listen for many times when your station starts to fade in and create interference, then you wouldn't be sure that it was Jupiter. But you see, there you've got a handle on the situation, because all you do is grab hold of the knob and set and turn it over.
Right.
And if the station goes away, and the Jupiter doesn't.
Right.
And so this is what the observer is trying to do.
What, can you just give an example, as you've already done, a little bit, of the main difference between what Jupiter sounds like and what thunderstorm?
Well, of course, everybody's heard thunderstorms on the radio. You get these very sharp crashes. And the Jupiter noise, there are really two types of them. They're distinguished now, the L bursts, the L very ingeniously standing for long, and the S burst, where obviously S stands for short. And the L bursts, the best analogy that I know of, I think the one that Colin Barrow was responsible for, at least first I recall hearing it, waves breaking on the beach, ocean waves breaking on the beach, is sort of slow roaring rumbling sound. That sort of thing. Nothing at all like
sharp corrections. Mm-hmm. That's real static. And it's almost impossible vocally to emulate the S verse, but the best analogy there that I've heard anyone, maybe I even thought of this one, was hail falling on a tin roof. It wouldn't occur to many Floridians. But, right. You know, that gives a very, very sharp, rattling, yeah. Rattling kind of sound. Again, not at all likely to be confused. I guess the L bursts are too long. Mm-hmm. The waveform is not steep enough to confuse the terrestrial static, and I guess with the S verse, the wavefront is too steep.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Because they're both in different time domains in the terrestrial static.
Okay, well, we got off on this when I brought up the question of.
Of Saturn.
Yeah, well, and Venus.
Oh, of Venus, yeah.
Well, both, lots of things. People were going wild this season with low frequency.
The point being that John Krauss felt that he had this radiation from Venus. He was fairly positive about the identification, but it perfectly well matched his infrared pattern. But apparently, in the light of hindsight, which is always the best kind, it must have been terrestrial interference that he rather soon recognized himself. And we always felt that basically the problem was that he did his, as I recall the situation, he did his observing in the evening. At an eastern elongation of Venus, and we tried to confirm it, but we always did our observing at a western elongation just before dawn and morning, which from a physiological point of view is less desirable, but from an ionospheric point of view, it's vastly quieter. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, the quietest time at definitely wavelength, mm-hmm. just before dawn, and of course in the late afternoon is the noisiest.
Yeah. So did you try to confirm these Venus?
Oh yes, we put in a lot of time.
Did you ever publish in that finding?
Yes, I believe so.
Surely we did. In the abstract.
Yeah, surely we did. We had a paper in which we summarized a number of these. I think it was in volume 134 of APJ.
Okay, well I only went up to 1960. This is getting later.
Yeah, this would have probably been one of our papers in the early 60s in which we summarized the observations of several planets in one paper. And I'm sure we reported the negative results on Venus.
What about comets? It seems like a lot of people were enthusing over, there was one particular comet, what was the name, 58 or so.
Was it, was it a Cassini, the one that had the spike?
No, that was 60. Five or so.
No, this was 57.
Okay, you got mixed up. Anyway, there was a comet that era where there were several reports and they disagreed with each other.
We tried to observe, we did some observing of a comet, the passage of a comet, and I don't remember what year it was. It conceivably could have. No, I think it might have been later. Yeah, it was later than that, because I remember we had moved our observatory from the original site we had in this campaign on this comet, because we had an interferometer in operation at that time. We never had any interferometer at the old site. We observed this initial site of the student observatory. We only observed there about two apparitions, and then we moved. It was virtually mad room for antennas, and then we moved to another site still on campus, but on the fringe of campus on agricultural land. And we had built an interferometer there, a 22 megahertz interferometer, by the time we tried to do these comet observations. And so I don't remember exactly what year, but I do remember that we among others, tried to make decrementic observations. This comet came up absolutely.
Do you think that there were these various over enthusiastic interpretations simply because people were not appreciating the problems of noise?
Probably so, because of course it's of all the radio astronomical bands, it's the noisiest number of points of view. It's the heart of the decrementic spectrum lies right across the ordinary shortwave band. Amount of activity. And there are also bands in there where people use all kinds of infernal machines, like diaphragm machines and plywood machines. machine really is.
Gluing.
Electromagnetic heating for gluing plywood and so on. And so there's an awful lot of man-made interference and power line leaking neon signs. I hate to tell you how many hours we spent driving up and down highways with portable radios looking for which motel it was whose neon sign was leaking and causing interference at the radio observatory. We'd notice it particularly every time there was a little fog or a little mist, you know, it encouraged a breakdown of these signs.
Yeah.
And sometimes just essentially put us out of business. And, you know,
what was your...
since we couldn't observe, we'd jump in the car and drive up and down the road looking for the sign.
Yeah, what was your procedure when you found it?
Ask them to fix it.
And were they usually?
Astonishingly cooperative. Yeah. Very apologetic. We never ran into anybody who was the least bit ugly about it. I was like, oh, gee, I'm sorry.
You didn't know my sign could do that.
No, glad you told us. We'll do something about it. Mm-hmm. And they did. It's amazing how far it
is. Now, I find in the AJ in 1960, University of Florida Radio Observatory report, which apparently was the first time that you felt like you were an astronomical observatory and you put a report in.
It was the first time we joined. Subscribed to the journal, right. Even knew there was such a thing.
But all of this that you had done in the late 50s was planetary.
Yes.
Radio astronomy.
Yeah, that's right.
In the comet, perhaps.
Yeah. The comet was probably early 60s.
Now, what about a paper in Nature in 59 by Smith, Carr, and Perkins, solar bursts received at night?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Let's start with that.
We got, you know, the Type 3 solar bursts are like the solar bursts. If you've ever heard one, you will always recognize it. There's hardly anything else you can confuse it with, because it has this build up and then this beautiful exponential fall. And so I forget who was observing. I don't remember whether it was I or who it was. Anyhow, heard this humongous solar burst at 3 o'clock in the morning or sometime like that. Unmistakably a solar burst. And it seemed passing strange. And since the sun was many hours rising. So, as I recall, we corresponded with some solar observatory around the other side of the air. Sure enough, it was a big burst. At that time, we thought this was a curious enough propagation phenomenon, so we wrote up a little note and published it in the Nature. It's calling attention to the fact that, by golly, such things can happen.
I've never heard of anything. Have you ever seen anyone else report such a
thing? No, I haven't, but I suspect people probably have heard. You know, it's the same sort of thing we used to hear reports when I was working on the radar during the war about people receiving 10 centimeter radar all the way across the Indian Ocean by some kind of peculiar ducting effect.
Right.
Oh, incidentally, along the same line, I very well remember on a number of occasions listening to Jupiter noise storms, which continued after Jupiter had set. One I remember following until something like 10 or 12 degrees below the horizon.
Whoa.
It just kept right on. Peculiar. Obviously some peculiar ducting effect in the atmosphere.
What about the paper Carr, Smith, and Bolhagen, is it
pronounced? Bolhagen. Heinz Bolhagen P.
And Fizrev Letters in 1960, in which you correlate the Jupiterverse with Earth's geomagnetic activity and thereby deduce that its solar wind, essentially, is influencing these things. Were you the first to establish that, would you say?
Well, I think about the same time as I recall Jim Warwick was doing some work along similar lines, probably nearly simultaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those strange things, like geophysical correlations there have to be. And we've worked intensively on this since that time. As a matter of fact, we've got two doctoral students who, this is not their sole thesis work, but it's in each case a fairly significant part of their thesis work, doing it right now, looking for correlation between the Jovian decametric emission and geophysical events or solar events. We're getting a little more sophisticated now in the sense that we're trying to tie the thing together with models of the solar wind and propagation times out of the solar wind out to Jupiter and all that kind of stuff, and then use the spacecraft observations that come along in the meantime. But it's one of those strange things because you can find periods in the data when you seemingly get striking correlations. And you can find other periods where, you know, it doesn't look like anything.
Just a strong reverse, and yet there's no correlation.
And we think one of these two doctoral students that I'm talking about may have come up with the answer to this in that he investigated a period in which there was very stable interplanetary magnetic field, very stable solar sector field, and found the correlation during this period of very unusually stable interplanetary magnetic field pattern. Investigated it in another period, more or less, as control, didn't find the correlation. So maybe this is the answer. But if you have a stable interplanetary field, then the situation is well enough organized so that you can find a correlation. But it's a kind of a frustrating thing. I wouldn't, at this particular moment in time, stake my reputation on the fact that there is a definite correlation, but we've certainly been suspicious enough and had enough positive results over the years that we're still working on trying to demonstrate a cause-effect relationship.
Were there any other correlations in those early days? Solar activity and Jovian activity?
Well, there's this long-term variation in the mean level of Jupiter activity. And it's no small effect. In fact, if you average the probability of occurrence of Jupiter noise over all longitudes of Jupiter to wipe out the source effect, so that you just kind of get do this over an apparition, so that you just kind of get an apparition-wide mean rate of radiation independent of what longitude of Jupiter happens to be turned toward the Earth. You find that between Jupiter maximum and Jupiter minimum, there is about an order of magnitude difference in the probability of occurrence. As I said a little while ago, we were lucky in a sense, in that we had our first real full apparition in 1957, which was a good one, but it was on the declining leg, or a very sharply declining leg of this. And 58 and 59, we got so little radiation that Tom Carr stroked his chin and said, "My God, we're studying a dying phenomenon." He was particularly concerned about it. It was doing the doctor of radiation. But it came back. And in the early 60s, around 63, it had tremendous rate of radiation. Then we went through another minimum, and now, once more, it's back up. Last year was as big as the 63 minimum. And so there seems to be a long-term cyclic change in Jupiter's mean rate of emission, or at least in our mean rate of receiving Jupiter.